Morning to each of you. Greeting the name of Jesus this morning. Good to see our visitors here with us this morning as well. Welcome to worship with us. Well, this week I was kind of in a turmoil because what do you preach on after a week of revivals? I mean, is there anything more to talk about? And I know that's exaggerated a little bit, but it is some of the thoughts that you think. And it's not often I take a poll from my family about what I should try to think and preach about this. And so anyhow, one evening we were talking about it, and the children were like, well, whatever you do, preach something simple, something that's easy to be understood. Or one of them said, well, don't preach on prophecy. And I guess he said that because they know that if I get in a tight pinch, that's always somewhere I can go. But and so I was thinking about that this week. Maybe what should I preach on after a week of revivals? And even beyond that, I know there's a number of subjects I want to preach on here, because I do have next spring in March, I have an assignment to preach 10. There's 10 assigned messages that I need to preach in one of the western states, Idaho, and what's the neighboring state? I can't remember. But anyhow, and so I do need to start working on them, but some of them take some more thought and preparation than what I had time for this week. And so one of the things I do enjoy doing is just taking a passage that's what I'm going to call a classic, an old classic, or something that's a familiar passage, and trying to make it come to life. And I don't really think I decided on a passage until, I think it was yesterday. I'd like to preach a message from Psalm 139. Psalm 139, to me, is kind of known of it as a, if you want to call it a classic, it's one of its kind, that's one of the better of its kind. It's one of the ones that people turn to for devotions a lot. It's one that people turn to for help in time of trouble. And on the list can go. But Psalm 139, if we think about this psalm, it was written, I don't know what your Bible says, but it was written to the chief musician. It means David, he wrote it, and then he handed it on to the chief musician, which is Asaph. If you go to, I think it's 1 Corinthians 16, it says that Asaph was chief of those. And so this was taken and was handed to him, and I guess what he was supposed to do is to put notes to it and make it into something musical, or something that was to be used in their worship services. And so Psalm 139, there's a reason that it is appealing to us, and one of the reasons is because it was made to be that way, and David wanted it more than just read. He wanted it sang. He wanted it sang in their worship services. And so this is a psalm that was probably sang quite often through the Old Testament. And we have a reason to look at it this morning. Let's start reading Psalm 139, verse 1. O Lord, thou hast searched me and known me. Thou knowest my down sitting and mine uprising. Thou understandest my thought afar off. Thou compassest my path and my lying down, and art acquainted with all my ways. For there is not a word in my tongue, but lo, O Lord, thou knowest it altogether. Thou hast beset me behind and before, and lay thine hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high, I cannot attain unto it. Whither shall I go from thy spirit, or whither shall I flee from thy presence? If I ascend up into heaven, thou art there. And if I make my bed in hell, behold, thou art there. If I take the wings of the morning, and dwell in the uttermost part of the sea, even there shall thy hand lead me, and thy right hand shall hold me. If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me, even the night shall be light about me. Yea, the darkness hideth not from thee, but the night shineth as the day. The darkness and the light are both alike to thee. For thou hast possessed my reins, thou hast covered me in my mother's womb. I will praise thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are thy works, and that my soul knoweth right well. My substance was not hid from thee when I was made in secret, and curiously wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. Thine eyes did see my substance, yet being unperfect, and in thy book all my members were written, which in continuance were fashioned, when as yet there were none of them. How precious also are thy thoughts unto me, O God! How great is the sum of them! If I should count them, they are more in number than the sand. When I awake, I am still with thee. Surely thou wilt slay the wicked, O God. Depart from me, therefore, ye bloody men. For they speak against thee wickedly, and thine enemies take thy name in vain. Do not I hate them, O Lord, that hate thee? And am I not grieved with those that rise up against thee? I hate them with perfect hatred. I count them my enemies. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts. And see if there be any wicked way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. One of the things that is interesting to me is to try to find out why the psalm was written. What was behind David's life that made him write this psalm at this time? And some psalms, they don't really know, and I guess this is maybe one of them, but some at least believe that it was written around the time where he became king over Israel. And so he had, at that point in David's life, he had a number of things that had happened to him that he had learned to work through and understand life, and a lot of things he started to understand. And this psalm was a reflection of some of those things that God had done for him and where he was right now. And as I read this psalm, it seems to be a psalm of reflection. And he's thinking back, and this is what he's remembering, and all the things that he has went through in his life. And so there may be a little background to that psalm, even though we're not totally sure. But to me, as I look at this psalm, as I studied into it, it seems that there are three problems that David was looking at in his life. And he said, you know what, this is what happened to me, and here's how I looked at them. I'd like to just briefly look at what the problems were. And some of this comes to light when we do a little word study. In verse 3 is the word compassus. Now, so the first problem we'd like to look at is, thou compassest my path and my lying down. And I think I've read those verses through all the years, all the times I've read the Bible, and I always thought that the word compassus would mean to surround, and to, he walks around my path and he surrounds it, okay? That seems to be the meaning of it. But you look it up and it actually means the opposite. It means to scatter. It means to winnow. Now, do you know what winnowing was in the Bible? They didn't have the combines that we have today. They brought this, all their grain in, and they had it in a pile, and then they would take the fork. On a windy day, they would take their fork and they would throw it up in the air. And the grain would drop and the chaff would fly out. And doesn't that change the meaning of verse 3? Doesn't it make it look different to you? But I'd ask us the question, doesn't that what God does to our life sometimes? Doesn't that make sense? That sometimes it feels like God takes a pitchfork into my life and my plans, and he takes it for a big throw. It makes sense. We can connect with that, right? Second problem that David was facing is in verse 5. As he looked at life and he was reflecting on his life, he said, verse 5, thou hast beset me behind and before, and laid thine hand upon me. Now, the word beset there means to surround or enclose, or actually means to harass. Does God harass you? Maybe from a human perspective. That's probably not quite a correct term, but it means that David's simply saying that he would turn this way and he would run into a block wall. And he'd turn this way and he'd run into another wall. And he's saying, God, you know, there are times in my life that, you know, you just closed the door on something that I was wanting to do. And we can connect with that. You know, sometimes God closed the door so quick that we look at it and say, what was that all about? Or he closed the door so fast we feel like we almost hit our nose. And you know what? Something we had planned, something we thought about, all of a sudden, God is saying, boom, here's the boundaries. And we either say, okay, what's the next step? Or we say, okay, God, I get the point. And so, now let's understand that these are not things that were necessarily inflicted by other people, but rather, this was God. This was God's working. This was God speaking into David's life. Things that God brought into his life, okay? And then the third problem we see that he was facing, at least he was thinking about, is the desire to run from God. We see that here in verse 7. Now, I think he was past it all, and so he was reflecting on it. He says, well, where am I going to go? Where am I going to flee? If I go to heaven, thou art there. If I make my bed in hell, thou art there. If I take the wings of the morning, I just go get out of here, you're there. And so even there, you're going to lead me. And he said, you know, if I go out into the darkness, you're there as well. And to you, there's no difference between light and darkness. You see it all. And it's a little bit, you know what happens sometimes if you've ever had to surround an animal, okay? And you tried to get them in. And you're blocking them out. And, you know, you come to a point where you don't know what the animal's going to choose when they're surrounded. And you know you got to be careful, because if they choose to just calm down and go where you want them to, everything's all right. But, you know, they might bolt, and you need to be ready. And I think that all of us can understand that in life. At least I know I can. Maybe we could start with some simple illustrations. I remember when I was working at Martin's, there was a man there who was he was a talented man. He was a lot of good about him. But he was upset about something, and he come in one day to the man that was his authority, and he had a company truck and company phone, and he threw his keys down and his company phone, and he said, "Unless something changes, I'm done. Just, you know, this is the way it is." And the man he was talking to, he said, "You pick your keys back up and you put your phone back in your belt, and we're going to talk. That's not how we solve issues around here." But I think we all understand that feeling, that desire to, okay, that's the way it's going to be. Here it is. Okay, and now maybe you don't connect with that. But maybe you can connect with, ladies, have you ever made a meal and somebody complains? Now, I hope that we don't tolerate complaining in our home about food. But what's your thoughts? Okay, if someone's going to complain about the work I did, fine, make it yourself. I mean, isn't that kind of how you feel sometimes? You see, we all can connect with that understanding. I've seen it in church life. You know, a person can choose to either face their problems or run. And, you know, even in our heart, you know, I can remember it as a young minister wanting to run from what God had laid upon me. And so we understand this struggle. You know, it's not uncommon. We can go in the Bible. We look at Moses, and he was like, "God, I can't speak. I can't talk." And God's like, "Okay, I'll give you Aaron." And he listened to Moses that time. But it seemed like, as we read Moses' life, it seemed like he probably did know how to talk. He probably could have. Saul, when they went to get him, he was what? Hiding among the stuff. Job's wife told him to curse God and die. Jonah did run, and God found him. So this is kind of David's story. But it all makes sense if we think about David's story. The man who was called from the sheepfold, and he served with Saul. And then Saul began to treat him very roughly. And then finally, David was on the run. And so he connects all of these things. And it seemed like God probably had taken his life and took the pitchfork and threw it up in the air for a while. And it seemed like everywhere he turned, probably at one moment of his life, he was against something. Doors were closed in his face, so to speak. But now, the answer to some of these problems is, the answer is in the problem itself. What happens, okay, and I guess I already talked about that, but why do they take a pitchfork of straw and grain and chaff and all that's mixed with it and throw it into the air? Is it not to separate the chaff from the wheat, the good from the bad? Isn't that what it's all about? And so the answer to life and the answer to working through things in life is simply to allow that to happen in our life. Allow God to do that in our life. Take that pitchfork and throw it up in the air. And, you know, what comes out of that is always good grain. Or it can be. It should be. And I don't know how you live your life, but I pray for direction. I pray that God would show us the way. I pray that God would help us to know what to do, what direction to take in maybe various aspects of life. And so when God throws the door shut in your face, I guess he answered our prayer, you know? I mean, that's one of the ways that God shows us what his will is. And so sometimes the answer is in the problem itself. And we also have a picture here of what Jesus talked about as pruning in John chapter 15. Turn with me there. We'll read those verses just to get us another word picture that we want. We have the picture of the grain, of the wheat and the barley and the straw and all that being thrown into the air and separated out. But here's another picture of the pruning that happens in our life. In John 15, verse 1, "I am the true vine, and my Father is the husbandman. Every branch in me that beareth not fruit, he taketh away, and every branch that beareth fruit, he purgeth it, that it may bring forth more fruit. Now ye are clean through the word which I have spoken unto you. Abide in me, and I in you. As a branch cannot bear fruit of itself, except it abide in the vine, no more can ye, except ye abide in me. I am the vine, ye are the branches. He that abideth in me, and I in him, the same bringeth forth much fruit. For without me ye can do nothing. If a man abide not in me, he is cast forth as a branch, and is withered, and men gather them and cast them into the fire, and they are burned. We'll stop reading there, but it is showing us the process of how God looks at a life. And he looks at a person, and this is a person who is a child of God. It's not talking about working with the sinner. It's talking about the person who is a child of God, and he sees these dead branches, and he sees these branches, they're not bringing forth fruit, and he takes these pruning shears and just cuts them off, the master pruner. And he's also taking those that are bringing forth fruit, and he looks at that fruit and says, you know what? That's a tremendous fruit there. That's a good fruit. It's a fruit that I need. But I need more of it. And so he prunes it skillfully so that it brings forth more fruit. And so that is a picture of what's happening here in Psalm 139. Of a person who is a Christian, a person who's doing what's right, and God's taking their life and throwing it in the air for a bit to get everything sifted out. Or you could use the illustration of taking the pruning shears and going to work. Now, how did David face the pruning and the winnowing in his life? I'd like to just look at several areas that I believe that David went back to as he thought about that. Number one is God knows everything about us, past, present, and future. And that is brought out very clearly here in this psalm, Psalm 139. You know me. He says, God, you know me through and through. You know everything about my past. You know my present. You know my future. And if you've been here, if you're here and you're a married person, you've been married for any length of time, there's something that should happen in a marriage. And that is, you know, your partner knows things about you that nobody else knows. And, you know, and growing up, I know you've heard me say this before, but I never really opened up much to anyone until I was married, okay? That's just kind of the way I was. I'm not saying I did it right. Probably didn't do it right. But when you've been married for a length of time, your partner knows things about you that nobody else really knows. They know your weak points. They know your struggle points. And, you know, sometimes that they learn to understand the things that you hurt about. And they say, well, I heard what somebody said. Did that, are you okay? I mean, did that hurt? Or you understand. They see and they know those points. And they bring it together and they talk about it. They ask you about it. And they know the situations that may affect you. How did that situation affect you? How are you doing? Or maybe they say, okay, something bothering you? It just seems like there's something wrong. And, you know, they know that part about you. They know the things maybe you've never shared with anyone else. And I don't know how you find it, but there is such a comfort in having someone in your life that you can do that with, that understands you to that level, okay? At least I find comfort in that. But how much more do we have a God that we can just lay it all out? We can get on our knees in the morning and pray. God, you know me through and through. You know my struggles. You know the struggles that are dumb that I struggle with. You know these. You know everything. And so we just lay it all out. And the thought to know that God knows everything about me will either bring me rest or fear. And if I am clear with God and I have opened my heart to him, my sin is confessed, that those I can come to God and just clearly lay it out. God, you know who I am. You know everything about me. And that aspect brings, confidence. We can come to God. And so that is one of the tools that I see that David used as he faced the pruning of life. God, you know me through and through. Number two, God's presence is with me wherever I go. And we see that in the verses. More of the verse when he thought about, well, God, I don't really want what you have for my life. Maybe I'll just run from what you want for my life. But he realizes, you know what? Wherever I go, God is there. His presence will be with me. God's presence is with me wherever I go. And as I think about the importance of that, and men of the Bible, and men of God, Joseph being one, and others, that the thought of the presence of God was a tremendous impact in their life. It kept them from sin. It allowed them to live a faithful life away from home. But how can we, as I thought about it, how can we encourage that in our life? How can we have a life where I think about the presence of God often? And I believe the key to that is talking to God often, communing with Him often in life. You see, it's kind of futile to just say, I must remind myself of the presence of God. No, let's talk with God often, and then we will remember His presence. And I don't know how you live your life, but let's just talk practically. Then what I do, not that I do it right, but you know, even a day at home in the office, and it's just, there's not, you could say, well, there's not a lot to pray about on a day like that. But there is. You know, I can look out my window and I can see my wife leaving with the school children. And I think every time I see the van leave, I pray. You know, there's valuable assets in the van. God keep them safe. And sisters, I don't know, when your husband leaves for work, your sons leave for work, whatever it is, I hope you pray for them. Do you know how many wrecks there is in a day? People are killed. Pray for their safety. Pray for their spiritual safety. And you know, men, as you leave for work, and maybe your wife's still in bed under the covers, but pray for her. Pray for the family. There's just so many things like that that our minds can flip back and forth. There's so many times I leave, I get in the truck and I'm ready to leave, and maybe it's early in the morning or whatever, and you think about, you know what, God, I have a lot of traveling to do today, and there's a lot of things out here. Please bring me back safely to my family again. Constant communion with God. And you know, even a day at my desk, okay, maybe I have to call a customer and talk to them about something I really don't want to talk to them about. And so you pray first, right? Commune with God. Help me in this phone call. And maybe I'm here, I'm just bidding jobs and I'm pulling prices together. Dear God, help me not to miss anything on this project. And that's simple stuff, but you know, if an estimator makes mistakes, it can cost the company money. It does cost them money. And there are people that are depending on that for their livelihood. Or maybe I'm trying to design a dairy barn and working on the cow flow, and I can't quite get it to all come together to sort cows to a certain area. They want to do a three-way sort or more, whatever it is, and you're trying to say, how can I get this to come together? And I know that's Greek to you all, but God, help me to do this. Help me to design this. You know, you can be going down the road and you see somebody walking. Why not just, I don't know how to do all the time, but pray for them. Sometimes it's the way to do it. Pray for them. And I think about this morning, as we came to church this morning, and I don't know what you do, but I want to foster this and encourage this. Did we pray for the service before we came? It's a valid question. It should be yes, we did pray. You know, when it is my turn to teach Sunday school, have devotions, or to preach, I want people to pray for me, right? I mean, we want people to do it when we teach Sunday school. We want people to do their Sunday school lesson, right? I mean, I don't think anyone thinks that way. But, you know, there really is a direct connection between the prayer and the communion we have. If we're going to come here this morning and to think about the presence of God, we're going to have to commune with Him. And I encourage you, I don't do this every Sunday. I think every Sunday I pray for the service. That's something I always do. But even mention people by name. You know, we have a sheet that tells us that between Clement and Travis will be leading songs. We know that devotions will be between Lyndon and Mike. We know that adult Sunday school will be between Dean and Curtis. We know that youth Sunday school is Neil. Intermediate is Lamar. Junior is Tish. Elma is primary. Brenda is preschool. And I'm just saying, okay, not that I'm just saying, when we pray for the service, we commune with God. There is something more that's going to happen in our life when we come together here to worship. It just is that way. This psalm is one I see it as communion with God, is what this psalm is. God, David, speaking to God, communing with him, talking with him. And if we struggle with thinking about the presence of God, let's talk with him more, commune with him more. David did that very much. Psalm 4, verse 4, stand in awe and sin not. Commune with your own heart upon your bed and be still, Selah. Talk to God when you're laying in bed and can't sleep. Psalm 77, 6, I call to remembrance my song in the night. I commune with mine own heart and my spirit may diligent search. And so here was David, even in the nighttime, he was communing with God. Number three is, as I think about how David approached the pruning of God in his life, God created everything about me with purpose. God created everything about me with purpose. In fact, and in spite of the fact that sometimes God takes that pitchfork and just throws it up and it seems like it ruffles my life all up, and in spite of the fact that he puts roadblocks in that I don't understand, and in spite of the fact that other things may happen, I understand that I have been made in a special way for a special reason. I don't know how else to read Psalm 139. And God created everything about me with a purpose. The word fearfully, I'm thinking mostly of the verses here now in verse 14. I will praise thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are thy works, and that my soul knoweth right well. The word fearfully there simply means how we use it. When I stop and think about how my body was created, I just have to stand in awe of God at the tremendous technology that is in my, that I'm, how I'm made, if you want to call it that. I know that's not the quite right word. It makes us stand in awe and worship. And I don't know, I see Clements back there. You know, I suppose, I didn't ask you, but you know, that baby of yours is made perfect, and it came perfectly made. And I also think about the little son that we buried. It was only 6 inches long. But, you know, it was all there. It was all perfectly made. Who could do that? Who could form something in the womb? Perfectly all there. The shapes are all there. The fingers are all there. Perfectly formed. Now, the word wonderfully means set apart or put a difference. And I don't know, you know, in buildings, okay, I'm talking because this is my perspective. In buildings, I guess I've never, I don't know that we've ever done a duplicate. Maybe close sometimes. But I can remember, there's times customers say, well, just bring me a set of plans for something you did like that, and we'll do something like that, okay? Why do we do that? Because it's easy. Now, why doesn't God just duplicate people? But there's how many people here this morning, and you're all different? You all look different? You're all made different? And I know they say everybody has a twin in the world, but I don't know if there's really any truth to that. But the point is, you could go all throughout the United States, and you could look at people, and you would basically find nobody that looks like yourself. You are set apart. God made you specifically the way you are, and for a purpose, and for a reason. You are fearfully and wonderfully made. And there are just a few facts here. The human brain has a memory capacity which is the equivalent of more than 4 terabytes on a hard drive. Nerve impulses sent from the brain move at speeds of 270 kilometers per hour. A single human brain generates more electrical impulses in a day than all the telephones of the world combined. The average human body contains enough sulfur to kill all the fleas on the average dog, enough carbon to make 900 pencils, and enough potassium to fire a toy cannon, enough fat to make 7 bars of soap, and enough water to fill a 50-liter barrel. The human heart pumps 182 million liters, and these facts were in, metric, but the human heart pumps 182 million liters of blood during the average lifetime. 50,000 cells in your body die and were replaced by new ones while you're reading this sentence. The human embryo acquires fingerprints within 3 months of conception. At the end of a person's life, they can recall, on an average, around 150 trillion pieces of information. Human skin is completely replaced about 1,000 times during a person's lifetime. Nerve impulses in the human body move at 90 minutes per second. I don't know. Maybe it's not minutes. It might be millimeters or something. I'm not sure. 100,000 chemical reactions occur in the human brain every second. The strongest muscle in the human body is the tongue. Each of us has around 2,000 taste buds. The human eye can distinguish 10 million different colors. The human heart pumps blood at such pressure that it would be able to raise blood up to the fourth floor of a building. A person uses 17 muscles when they smile and 43 when they frown. Bones are 5 times stronger than steel. And the one about bones, I did check several. There's a number of references that say that bones are stronger than steel. And I guess they are brittle and they do break, but their strength is amazing. And that's only the surface, okay? There's only the surface of amazing facts about the human body. I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. Now, I want us to think about something. Okay, David looks at this. Before I go there, David looks at this and he goes, wow. So he looks at how his own body, you don't have to go very far to see the glory of God. Just look at your own human body. That's what David was doing. And he says, verse 17, he said, how precious are thy thoughts unto me, O God, how great is the sum of them. If I should count them, they are more in number than the sand. When I awake, I am still with thee. And that was his response to looking at his own human body. Saying, wow, God, how you must love me and appreciate me. Now, for us to try to make a connection of how the interest that God has in us, and I know Vernon talked about that a lot this past week or week ago, whenever it was, and I really appreciate it. I'm just going to think about it again. But so that we, to help us understand, I can remember when you work at designing buildings and you work at that kind of stuff, you remember details, especially the first ones you did, the ones that you labored through and worked through hard. You remember those details. You don't forget them. And Deshaun, that building you just finished or nearly finished, you will always remember that. It's probably the first one you took charge of. And when you go back to your uncle's place, you will have an interest in that building that you would not have if someone else would have did it. That's just a fact of life, okay? That's how it is with me. I can remember the first project I ran, the first one I was responsible for. I can remember the frustrations that were part of that job and what I should have did different. And I guess, I don't know, I guess, do you remember the first dress you sewed? Do you remember the ones you tore all the pieces out of? I'm just saying, when we make something, when we create something, there's an interest there that it's not there if somebody else does it. It's just a simple part of life. I guess you... Ladies, you probably remember the first meal you made for your husband. He probably don't remember, but you probably do. It's just things like that that stick in our mind. Why? Because we did it. We created it. And now, you know, the more genius of the things that we do, the more we remember. And we haven't even come any close. Not even anywhere close creating something to the equivalent of the human body. And so doesn't that show us the intense interest that God has in us, that he would create us with such tremendous talent and skill and such, well, it's beyond our mind. David talks about that. And so, number four, I think about the things, how David faced the pruning. It's God's deepest desire is for us to trust him. And I see that just woven throughout Psalm 139. All that we looked at so far, God's workings with us, God's knowledge about us, God's presence with us, how we are made, all is to try to bring us to the point where we learn to trust God. We learn to trust God. While that should be so simple, that it's not. You all know that. We struggle with that sometimes. It's not something he demands, but he asks for our hand. He asked for us to willingly give it to him. But at the same time, the Bible is clear, and we know from personal experience, that he will put pressure on us to learn to trust him. Yes, it's a choice that we willingly do that. But he does put pressure on us. And I just want to think with some verses here. But before we go to the verse here, I would like to... There's a quote, I think it was a quote or a little something I saw recently, and it was a little boy, or his mother, the mother told the little boy, here, you hold my hand, wherever they were going. The little boy said, no, I want you to hold my hand, because if I hold your hand, and I get scared, I might let go. But if you hold my hand, I know you'll never let go. Now I want to ask you, which way is it here in Psalm 139? Verse 10, it tells us. Even there shall thy right hand lead me, and thy right hand shall hold me. Do you see which way it is? It's our hand into God's. God holds my hand. And that is there, it is a, when we give that hand, it is a way of saying, God, I trust you. I give you my hand. You take it. You won't let go. We can trust God because of his protection. And David looks back to, clear back to the time when he was being created in his mother's womb. He said, thou hast possessed my reins. Now the word reins there is, it means kidneys. And it's just simply a, the best way I know to explain it is a misconception that people had in the Bible times. They thought that the kidneys were what we would call the heart and the soul, where it's where the emotions, the seat of the emotions and all that, they thought were the kidneys, but we understand the soul and the heart. And so, just a little sideline. But he says, there, thou hast possessed my reins and covered me in my mother's womb. And he knew that from such a little being, such little substance, from the very littlest of cells till he grew up, that there he was protected as he grew up. And that is one of the reasons David said, I can trust God because he protected me from being such a little person in my mother's womb. And he protected me there, and he will protect me in the future. Now, David ends this psalm on a strong note of trust, okay? He works down through all these things. And I'm skipping verses 19 through 22, simply because it's kind of part of the old covenant. It's part of, we understand, that was the way they thought back then, because vengeance was more of a part they played. But the last two verses are this. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts, and see if there be any wicked way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. And these are verses that are a challenge to me, because what is he saying here? What is David actually saying here? Search me, O God. And the psalm started with, Lord, thou hast searched me. And how did he search him? Well, he took him and he threw him up in the air for a bit. And he put blocks around him. You understand what I'm saying, how it felt at that time. So now he's saying, God, search me and know me. Try me. Throw me up in the air a few more times. And know my thoughts. You know, we don't say that to someone unless we would trust them, right? This is what David is saying. He is willingly giving God his hand. He's saying, search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts. Throw my life and my plans in the air again if that's what it takes. Put roadblocks in my life if that's what it takes. God, I want you to separate the chaff from the wheat. If there's wickedness in me, take it out. You show me the way that will lead to eternal life. And that was David's testimony here. What a testimony. What permission. What trust. Look to finish for the story. Small story. A group of scientists and Bodentists were exploring remote regions of the Alps in search of new species of flowers. One day they noticed, through binoculars, a flower of such rarity and beauty that its value to science was incalculable. But it lay deep in a ravine with cliffs on both sides. To get the flower, someone had to be lowered over the cliff on a rope. A curious young man was watching nearby, and the scientists told him they would pay him well if he would agree to be lowered over the cliff to retrieve the flower below. The boy took one long look down the deep, dizzy depths and said, I'll be back in a minute. A short time later, he returned, followed by a gray-haired man. Approaching the scientist, the boy said, I'll go over the cliff and get that flower for you if this man holds the rope. He's my father. Let's kneel for prayer.